sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Told you to take an extra base, Luke. Mommy. Daddy's managing again.
Scary.
Then there will be lawyers.
Whew. For the kids?
Good question.
Matt Cotrillo becomes the first father to be sued by his children for managing a game. Ryan Roberts on the draft in a moment. But first, our play-by-play call of the day.
No timeouts left. Here's Martin on the right sideline to Cole at the hash. Guarded by Slater. Starts back to the right. Cole to the basket. Puts it up right handed and good. And UConn leads by one. RJ Cole attacking the 10. Looking to throw it in. It gets it into Gillespie. Can't foul him. And Gillespie, blow by move to the basket. He runs over Cole. And it's over. I believe it's over. With 1.1 left.
It was over. I can confirm it from a distance. It's over. Gone. UConn beat Villanova last night. Yes, it felt like the old Big East again. How about that? Love it. Great win at Gamble. All right. Now we're going to talk about the draft. And with that, we bring in Ryan Roberts, Believe Podcast Network. He's their draft analyst. Also has a vote for the Davey O'Brien Award. Serger, welcome. It is a pleasure. Great to have you with us on the show this afternoon.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, appreciate you having me.
All right. So going into the combine, give me a couple guys that you think have the most to gain at the combine and a couple guys that might have the most to lose at the combine.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest headline that I'm kind of watching at the combine is I think that there is a lot of questions right now about the cornerback position as far as what is the pecking order right now. There's a lot of guys, it seems like, in the you know, high mainstream that kind of have a little more, you know, plugged in type of information, like the Dane Brugers of the world, Mel Kuypers, Todd McShays, that think that Ahmad Sauce Gardner from Cincinnati is kind of the perceived guy right now. Mm-hmm. But we've kind of been in the world where, you know, Derek Stingley's been the talked about guy at LSU for the last few years. I love Andrew Booth Jr. personally from Clemson. He's my top guy. And I think that when we're talking about separation in this class at cornerback, we're going to see after the class if there's guys that are, you know, somewhat packed together as far as similar grades. Then, you know, Derek Stingley running a 4.3 compared to maybe another guy running a 4.41 is although a 4.41 still a fantastic time for, you know, any corner. The fact that, you know, there's just a little bit of separation in some of these testing numbers, I think, is just going to dictate a lot of what the pecking order is. And then if there's some of these corners like the Trent McDuffies of the world out of Washington, or even Sauce Gardner, maybe doesn't test as well as other people think, do some start to second guess their evaluation. I really think that we're just going to kind of see that cornerback board reordering itself a little bit. And honestly, when we're talking about the testing numbers, sometimes the testing for certain positions is a little overblown comparative to others, but cornerback and wide receiver are two of the positions that the testing absolutely does matter, because they're just going to be increased space, and it absolutely matters how well they run, how well they change the direction, that type of conversation.
You reference wide receiver. How can Jahan Dotson fit into this scenario from Penn State?
Well, I think that the biggest thing for Jahan is the film this past year was fantastic. I admittedly went in out of the summer, and I was a little lower comparative to some people on him, just because I felt like the year before they used him a lot more as, you know, you're going to kind of win in the air and you're going to be more of an outside catch point type of guy. And this year I felt like he was a lot more nuanced in his route running, was able to create a lot more instant separation. So you want to see those testing numbers kind of validate what you saw in film this year. So I want to see his short shuttle be a great time. I want to see his three cone. I want to see the change of direction stuff be really good. And then he's supposedly going to be a, you know, potential 4.3 type of athlete, you know, based upon everything you're hearing with his track background in high school and all that good stuff too. So for him to separate himself, he's going to have to validate what you saw in film this year with the short area stuff and then his ability to win vertically with the speed. So if he's able to test and just kind of check off those boxes, I think first-round conversation is very warranted with the film that he put out this year.
A guy that came back this year for Penn State as well was Jaquan Brisker. I felt like this season he was one of those guys that, in coming back, he actually improved his draft stock. Where does he fit into this puzzle?
Jaquan Brisker is one of my favorite players in this draft. Another guy, admittedly, that I was a little lower on coming out of the summer, but I thought that his season was absolutely fantastic. I had like a early day three grade on him coming into the season. I have a firm second round grade on him, and mm-hmm. I think that he has definitely been one of the bigger risers because you always knew that he was very athletic. You knew that the talent level was there. I just felt like everything was just so much more consistent. I felt like he became more of a proactive player in zone, really, you know, forced a lot of takeaways, obviously, this year. But then also I felt like the tackling was more consistent in space, and he has the ability to be a striker. He's got a lot of physicality to him, and I think that he just checks a lot of boxes. And honestly, if you told me that when April comes around, the end of April, when the draft kicks off, if you told me that, because everybody knows Kyle Hamilton from Notre Dame is going to be the first safety off the board.
Hamilton's but terrific.
Yeah, Hamilton's obviously in a tier of himself, but mm-hmm. if you told me that there was another safety that snuck into the top 30 selections and was selected in the first round and was maybe the second safety off the board, and it was Jaquan Brisker, I wouldn't doubt it because I think that he just checks a lot of boxes, and I think he's a player that a lot of teams really like. I mean, even dating back to last year, I mean, he had a Senior Bowl invite that he left on the table because he wanted to come back and he wanted to prove something.
Right.
So I think he's put himself in a conversation to maybe be in the second safety off the board potentially.
Yeah, because I felt like Dotson and Brisker both improved their stock by coming back. It doesn't always happen, but they both did. All right, now let's get to a guy that I think, look, when it comes to the combine, he's going to blow everybody away in terms of size, body fat, the whole, you know, speed, the whole deal. But I think it's somewhat of a mystery to some people, you know, not here because we see him, is Brandon Smith, the linebacker. What's your read on him?
He's a funky player, man, to be very honest with you. Because last year, I mean, first and foremost, like you kind of illustrated, the kid looks like a million bucks. You know, he's 6'3", 6'3 and a half. He's 230-plus pounds, and he has a lot of length everywhere. And he was kind of used more as a, you know, that displaced Sam, like that overhang position in 2020. And you saw a lot of great things because, like, coming from depth, he's an incredibly explosive football player. He's got some zone awareness. And, I mean, he strikes people in the open field. He has a, I mean, there were some highlight hits on his film in 2020. Penn State used him a little more in a true stacked linebacker position this past year. And I just mm-hmm. I feel like his diagnostic skills are not up to par right now. I think that he kind of just – I think his eyes are a little slow, kind of working through some trash, you know, in near the line of scrimmage. So I feel like he's just a little late to a lot of things right now. But I think that the narrative's going to change a little bit on him because people are going to see these numbers. I mean, the kid legitimately is probably going to run in the 4.4s and have a close to a 40-inch vertical at 235-plus pounds. And people are just going to kind of forgive maybe some of the shortcomings. And I think that he's not a guy that necessarily we should be depending on him playing a high volume of snaps in year one. But certainly that type of caliber of athlete, somebody's going to take a chance on relatively early because, you know, that obviously all the traits are there for him to be a successful player.
All right. Now I want to transition to the quarterbacks overall. Now, this is just my opinion. There's not a first-round talent among the quarterbacks, my opinion. That doesn't mean there won't be first-round quarterbacks. There'll be quarterbacks taken in the first round. But in my opinion, I don't see any first-round talent. How do you stack up the quarterbacks, and do you think there's a first-round talent?
I would agree with your kind of diagnostic of the class, to be honest with you. I think that the issue with this class is why it's getting the you know the real blame as far as being a bad class is because I think that there is a lot of depth in the sense of there's guys that are day-two level prospects that have upside. Malik Willis out of Liberty, like if you got him somewhere in, you know, the 30s, 40s range, and you were developing him behind a guy and easing him in, even if it's, you know, Desmond Ridder somewhere in the third round or Corral from Ole Miss is a guy that maybe you take a gamble on somewhere on day two, or maybe even if you want to take one of those guys late first for a playoff team and just develop him behind an older veteran, like that situation, I think you can have some success, because I think it's a very this quarterback draft more than ever is a very situationally dictated position, which it is for the most part at quarterbacks. But I really think this year is going to be very dependent on where these guys land, with what coaching, with what situation. It's going to impact everything. And the problem is that the depth that I think that it does have, there's none of those Trevor Lawrences. There's no Trey Lances. There's none of these guys where usually those guys would be down the pecking order, because you have one or two guys that you're comfortable with at the top of the class. They're unfortunately getting pushed up the board, and it's making it look like this is a insanely bad class, which it's not a good class at the top. There's no question. I do think there is some depth, though. The issue is, again, that teams are going to panic for quarterbacks.
Yeah.
That means that a guy like a Malik Willis is going to go way too high, although in most years I think that he would be a guy that a lot of people like because he's a developmental option, but now somebody might press to think that maybe he's the savior, which I don't think he is early on especially.
Yeah, that's what – look, there'll be quarterbacks picked in the first round. Kenny Pickett will be picked in the first round. Malik Willis will be picked in the first round. And anybody with any common sense would be like, I'm not doing that. But you're right. Teams need quarterbacks. And, of course, we all know if he comes here, we'll develop him. Really? You will?
Yeah.
I thought Brandon Whedon did a great job. Fabulous. Well, he's a second-round pick, but still.
It happens every year, man. Like, they can fix them, right? And especially with a guy like Malik Willis, like, I get it, because – you know, he has a big arm, obviously. He's incredible talent. And you would assume that with better NFL coaching, in theory, you would be able to get the most out of him. And teams are always just going to panic because, I mean, I'll be forefront. Like, I miss on Josh Allen. Like, I feel like a lot of the media did miss on Josh Allen because you don't quite understand the grasp of the mental side of the conversation. And you don't quite understand, like, him falling in with Brian Daboll and Scott McDermott, and what they had working over at Buffalo was the perfect situation. So I think that those types of situations are going to make people jump at it. But I agree definitely with your premise that I don't think that there's anybody on film in 2021 that is worthy of a first round pick. But ultimately, I still think that 3 to 4 are going to get selected just because that's the nature of the conversation.
I'll say this: I lucked into actually seeing Josh Allen play a game in college. And that's why I was a little more impressed with him with some, because I watched the game. And it was because I was making a speech at the Penn State Club in Michigan, and the speech was at Eastern Michigan, and Wyoming that night was playing Eastern Michigan. So when the speech was over, I went out and watched the game and thought, wow, this guy can really play. But it was against Eastern Michigan.
Right.
That to me is one of the bigger issues with quarterbacks, where I have a lot of trouble judging. Like, I can't tell you how good Trey Lance is. I still can't. Because I haven't seen him against, like, what I perceive to be high-level competition. I say the same thing about Malik Willis. I can almost say the same thing in some ways about Kenny Pickett in the ACC.
Yeah, you're not wrong. You're not. I mean, and it's a very valid point, right? It really is, because that's why the Senior Bowl was this perceived big moment for a guy like Malik Willis. And, I mean, give him credit for what he did, because the first day I thought was awful. Like, I thought he was really bad the first day.
Right.
He got better each and every day, which is obviously a positive sign. But, like, you're absolutely correct. It is, you know, when you watch the Liberty film, I mean, there's a lot of RPO concepts. There's a lot of him running outside of structure. And he's just he came from Auburn originally, right? So it's not like he's a
– Sure.
You know, it's not like he was a, you know, Sun Belt athlete his entire career. He was an SEC athlete that just kind of worked into – being a Sun Belt quarterback, and he's just the best athlete on the field at all times, which makes you have pause, but you're just hoping that in the right situation, again, like a coach can take the best of what he is and can work it within a structure. Because that was the biggest thing with Josh Allen, in my opinion, is like Josh Allen had maybe the best arm I've ever seen. Like, that's not, like, it's easy to quantify. Mm-hmm. And he's a great athlete. He's a big kid. Yeah. Like, all that stuff was true. Mm-hmm. But, like, it was just such a mixed bag at Wyoming. You're just wondering, can he work in structure? I can see what he can do out of the pocket. I can see what he can do as a runner. But can you really work the traits that he has internally as a system, you know, inside of a system? And that's just kind of the question that we don't know the answer to. But I think somebody's obviously going to take the gamble there.
And then at some point, they'll do the individual workouts. And what makes that comical is two guys who had two of the worst pro day workouts were Lamar Jackson and Peyton Manning.
Yep.
Peyton Manning's pro day workout was not good. Right? Yep. I think it worked out okay. All right. What a pleasure, Ryan. Great to have you with us on the show today. We look forward to catching up many times during this process.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I really appreciate it.
Ryan Roberts. All right. Don in Mifflinburg has been patiently waiting through all of that. Don, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
A pleasure to talk with you as well. Thank you for taking the call. In the last half hour, you were talking about football revenues funding the other 30 sports at Penn State. Of the 31 sports in total, other than football, what ones are self-sustaining?
Men's basketball.
Period.
Yep. Hockey, men's hockey breaks even.
How about women's volleyball?
Not even close. It's seven figures in the loss.
Oh my, that is a surprise. We're season ticket holders, and it's well attended.
Oh yeah, attendance. Believe it or not, Don, attendance does not equate to always to profit and loss. If that were the case, then wrestling would be a great profit generator. And mm-hmm. wrestling loses between about $500,000 and $1 million every year. And the difference is the media rights mean everything what we're talking about here. So let's take men's basketball. Men's basketball, which you know certainly generates tickets. I mean, it's not like they don't. I mean, like the game the other day was with Minnesota was not well attended because it was a Thursday afternoon at 4, but they sold 8,400 tickets. But the difference is that in men's basketball, you have a TV contract. Those TV contracts are for football and men's basketball. So the TV contract with Fox, like tomorrow night, Friday night's games on Fox Sports 1, for example, that's all part of the package, and that's where they make the money. So men's basketball can usually make anywhere from $4 to $7 million in a year profit. So they're in the black. Football is up in the $40 to $50 million range. Everybody else, and men's ice hockey is right around breaking even. There've been a couple of years a little bit below, a couple of years above, like $250,000 above. Everybody else loses money. So women's volleyball usually is in the $1 million to $1.5 million loss. Wrestling usually is about $600,000 to about $1 million loss. Women's basketball has been the toughest of all. That's usually in the $3 to $5 million loss range. But media they don't have media rights. They had no media rights.
And so you know, even when they're on BTN, they don't get money.
No, because that's all part of the BTN overall contract that comes into play, and that goes under the line of both football and men's basketball. Because I mean, men's basketball is on when they're not on Fox Sports 1 or ESPN, they're always on BTN. Football's mm-hmm. on BTN how many times? Those are just any BTN broadcast for other sports are just part of the tag along part of the broadcast along the way. So that doesn't make any difference at all. Makes none.
Okay.
And they
Thank you very much for educating me.
Here's the other part too, Don. They don't have radio rights. The radio package with Penn State and Learfield is a big number, but that big number is for football and men's basketball. Wrestling doesn't have a network. Women's basketball only has a couple stations. Hockey has a couple stations. Men's basketball has 50. Football has 60. Talk show on Thursday nights, things like that. So that's another part. The radio rights number is also a big number for football and men's basketball. The bottom line is everybody gets a cut. Everybody gets a cut of all this. They just take the profits from the two profit lines of football and men's basketball, and they make sure that you know they're able to spread it around. That's why the next TV contract's so important for everybody, because everybody, including women's volleyball, will benefit from that new TV deal.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome, Don. Pleasure. All right. Yeah, it's just, that's the way collegiate sports is. Collegiate sports you know, when we talk about the business of sports, in the business of sports, this is not like, so let's use Sunbury Motors, Ford, Lincoln, Mercury, okay? Well, you notice that Mercury doesn't exist anymore because they either were losing money as a division or they weren't making enough money. That's how normal business works. Well, if normal business practices were applied to intercollegiate athletics across the country, football and men's basketball would be played and probably nobody else. Well, you know, like I said, hockey's about in the break-even area here, but other hockey programs lose money. All right? But football and men's basketball across the board, they make money. What makes intercollegiate athletics work is that all the excess profit from football and the excess profit from men's basketball, which is significantly less than football. I mean, let's not pretend they're in the same realm, but men's basketball can make between $4 and $7 million on a given year and be on the plus side. Okay. That then goes in, and that money is, a lot of it is distributed to the other programs to make sure that they are sustainable and can compete at the highest level. That's how it works. It's, as I've said many times on the show, sports is one of the areas where socialism works. And that's the socialist model right there as to how it works. And this is how it's been done really since 1960. And when the AFL said, hey, look, let's get our national contract and split it evenly so everybody has a fighting chance. Well, this is what they do in the Big Ten. They split the money evenly, and football and men's basketball also have in their attendance clauses. The other sports don't. In other words, when Penn State gets a crowd for wrestling, Penn State keeps the money. When Penn State gets a crowd for men's basketball, there is an escalator number that I think floats from 27,000 to 75, depending on what it is, and it's thrown into the pot and then divided eventually at the end of the year. Football is between 600,000 and a million on a home game that goes into the pot and gets divided. They have revenue sharing. The other sports don't. I mean, that's how they've worked it for years. You know, bowl money, if you don't go to a bowl game, you get the exact same cut as the team that does. There's no difference. I mean, that's how they work it for everybody. And the money goes to help all the other sports. And that's the way it's been for a long time. You know, those are the two sports that make significant coin, and in part because of their media rights. And their media rights and the Power Five mean everything. NCAA basketball tournament, Mike. Penn State gets an NCAA basketball tournament cut even when they don't go. That's why the year that they cut back on, because there was no tournament and they only used the insurance money, everybody got about only a third of what they normally get. It affected athletic departments across the board. Yeah. So, yes, women's volleyball is extremely well attended. Wrestling is extremely well attended. But it's not enough to put them over the top financially. In fact, people are always shocked by that because they think they see the attendance and go, wow, and I would too. It's just there's a reality to it. It's just not enough to make up for it, for the deficit. But it doesn't matter to me. As long as they're able to compete, there's plenty of money for them to do it, and that's all I care about.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you, the other guy's way or the SMC way. The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf, online at sunburymotors.com. Ford, Kia, Hyundai, best in new inventory, great pre-owned inventory. Best in pre-owned inventory as well. And a service department that backs all this up. At, I don't care if it's inspections, they're great. Routine, great. And don't forget about the diagnostics. They can handle all of it. It's all at Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. All right. Let's turn our attention now to basketball. Bring in John Crispin. John, a pleasure. Great to have you with us.
I'm in demand nowadays. This is good. I like that.
Come on.
Like
you've been in the last few days, you've been in a lot more demand, haven't you?
With everything going on. Everybody wants your take on things.
I know.
It's unbelievable.
I heard you with Childers and Neuheisel, I think, yesterday or a couple days ago. That we're talking, we're kidding about being in demand.
Right.
Just very quickly, it's as Dick Girardi would say, yesterday's news, but, it still was news nonetheless. In the end, did the Big Ten handle it right post-mortem?
I'm not really sold that they did. I think the way I described it, as I said, I think the punishment was reasonable but perceivably lenient, which sounds like such a diplomatic and political way to say it.
When did you turn that way on me?
I know. We live in such a sensitive world that it's like if I say something that makes too much sense, I'm gonna create so many frenemies. You know what I mean? Where people that's in my face, they'll like me, but behind my back, they'll mean tweet. But the reality is, I don't think they took into consideration the fact that something similar happened last year, and that's the one thing that jumps out to me. I also think that the conference and schools fall victim to social media narrative because they rely on what's being said to maybe justify what they want to do. Where they find enough people that say, well, Greg Gard, he did this, he instigated. And I'm saying, hang on a second. That thing he did happens every single game, whether you're happy or not.
Right.
Touching someone on the arm, is that a threatening thing? Absolutely not. Let's not create a false narrative around instigating something that turned into a near brawl.
Right.
Ultimately, it's the responsibility of Juwan Howard to not lose his mind. And this is the second time he's done it.
Right.
And I felt like the first time it happened is one of those things, again, with Mark Turgeon, that you say, that can't happen. Given the responsibility you have to represent your institution and represent these young men in a way that you are a leader and you set the example. I felt like that couldn't happen last year, and here it happens again. Now, at the same time, I always say, look, I have a bias towards these people as human beings because we speak to them as human beings. I have an empathetic perspective for them. And that being said, I'm hopeful for them. I hope they do well. But you have to be able to separate your own perspective from the reality that is you don't respect the responsibility you have to lead this program. And if something like this continues, which it seems like it already has, I felt like it could have been the rest of the season. And quite frankly, it probably should have been given the fact that this happened last year.
Yeah. No, see, I pointed that out earlier in the week because of the Mark Turgeon incident. Last year, I felt this was the second time through for him,
And that's why I had advocated that it had to be the regular season plus the Big Ten tournament. But
Think about this, though. Like, think about this. Like, this is something, like, I've kind of dealt with this when I call American Athletic Games with Penny Hardaway.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't do what someone else has had to do in terms of persevering, growing in the profession the way most have to. And I think what that does is it establishes the expectation on you. So when you do get that job, you have adhered to an expectation all along, and that becomes the baseline, the foundation for expectation.
Right.
I don't think some of these guys who come from the NBA, and this is not a knock on them anyway, it's just a reality. You know, it's not an excuse. It's just a reason. I just think if you're handed this job, there's a part of you that's still a player, and you can't believe that people are criticizing you. I mean, to this day, Penny Hardaway won't let me come to shoot around because I criticized them in November. I mean, that's what we're dealing with.
Because you analyze what was going on in November.
Yes. I mean,
okay.
I predicted a 20-point loss. And
right.
Then I said, look, this is a team that's disconnected. I hear about all this smoke. Well, you've got it. You've got to do something with it. And that leads to, well, how dare you take a shot at me? And it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
If you coached and you were an assistant and you were around this, you'd understand that that's harmless and that's just the job. And the position you're in will always – you know, it'll always get some degree of criticism, and it can't be something that's taken personal. I think part of it is Juwan Howard, because of who he is, still thinks of himself as Juwan Howard, a player.
Right.
And there's a pride, there's an ego there that, you know, as you grow, you have to realize, like, I need to put that aside because I represent something bigger than myself. The responsibility I have is far greater than just myself.
Right.
It's these other guys around me. And I think that's something that you learn as you grow in the profession. And I think it's hard for some of these guys who, frankly, like, you couldn't pay them enough money, you know, in terms of what they think they're worth. I mean, these are guys that have made, you know, luckily $100 million in their careers.
Sure.
And you think $2.5 million is going to keep them in line? It's just different. I think it requires a different approach from an athletic director and a different approach from a commissioner standpoint in terms of Kevin Warren and the Big Ten.
There have been fewer fouls called this season across the country than there were 5 years ago. It's about down 2 fouls a game from what I've seen.
Yeah.
And of course, in the Big Ten, I'm still seeing heavy physicality, and I have felt in the NCAA tournament, when they get other officials that may be more of a, quote, finesse league, and you and I know it's called differently. I felt the Big Ten has been hurt by that because they can't adjust to the style of play out there. Does uniformity need to come from a central location for this, or should the conferences continue to do the independent hiring they do?
I think the conferences should do the independent hiring. I just think we need to eliminate Big Brother from the process. I mean, what's happening is these officials are all held accountable by different people.
Right.
In the sense that they get grades. You know, some of these guys get halftime grades. This is what you missed. This is what you're doing wrong. I mean, who does well when some Big Brother is watching everything you do and judging everything? And then,
it's more than that.
Call this, you don't get NCAA tournament.
It's more than that, John. You and I both know, because, I mean, we're around it all the time, that the worst thing they can do is go back to the locker room and the play is on the phone.
Yes.
And they've got to look at it.
Yes. I mean, it's not good. And what it does is it eliminates the instincts that officials develop over time calling basketball games. I trust their instincts more so than I trust the black and white letter of the law.
Mm-hmm.
I think I said it in a broadcast where I said, I quite frankly, I was doing a game Sunday, and I said, I wish the officials just wore gray shirts, because that's how the game's played. That's where the game's won. It's in the gray, where not everything is black and white. We want to look at everything and say, oh, could that be a flagrant foul? I'm like, look, it could be if you're literal to the letter of the law, but the reality is that was in no way intended. It just happened. Let's not determine the outcome of a game on this literal interpretation of a silly rule, when in reality you're letting so many things go physically that are actually handicapping the Big Ten. It truly is. It is holding the Big Ten back in terms of when you look at the teams in the Big Ten this year and the potential scoring potential that some of these teams have, and then you're seeing games in the 60s and you're saying, what is going on?
Right.
Like, it's too physical. Whatever happened to freedom of movement?
And it's now gotten
back to this hand-checking that we used to play with.
Right. Well, yeah, you played with hand-checking, but there were certain games, and they were non-conference games, where you, Joe, Titus could move, and that's when you guys thrived
Yep.
Because it became a game of passing, cutting, and shooting.
Yep.
And to me, that plays
into space and all those things that we want to do this year.
Yeah, and to me, that's the best kind of basketball.
Yes. Yeah, 100%. And the thing is, it's funny how they did that thing where they say, oh, freedom of movement, and it becomes a point of emphasis, and then that lasts a little while. And they're like, well, scoring is up. Well, I'm like, well, scoring's up because foul shooting's up, but actually scoring's down because you're eliminating the flow from the game. You're eliminating rhythm. You're affecting the fluidity of basketball. And truth be told, the way the game's played today, you need to enhance fluidity. You need to enhance flow. And the officiating should. First off, I think the best way to do it, honestly, is to give them all six fouls and call fouls early so you establish the way the game is going to be called. I think once you do that, and then it's up to officials to be consistent thereon, you call a foul early. The NBA does it so well, where they call fouls early, and you're kind of like, they're calling that today? Well, they establish the way the game's going to be called, and it's up to the players to adjust to the game. I think players have the ability to adjust to the game more than they get credit for, but the problem is it's hard to adjust to the rigidity that we have today, right? There is an inconsistency with what's called, and there's also an inconsistency with from game to game how the game's going to be played. And frankly, I think it supports some of the inferior teams. Teams that are saying, you know what, if the game's in the 65-70s, we lose. So let's make it super physical and slow. Well, that's not good for anybody, and that's why we keep talking about Big Ten teams not winning a national championship, because ultimately, teams that win a national championship, they got to outscore their opponent. Defense travels. Yeah, whatever. Defense wins championships. Yep. But you still have to outscore your opponent.
Yep.
And the teams that have won recently, including Virginia,
played,
if you go back,
Virginia played offense. They're a team that won, went from the, hey, let's go 55, 56 possessions a game to let her fly. Yep. And that see, offense in college football and offense in college basketball in recent years have been the ones that have been winning.
Yes. And a defense, honestly, that supports your offense, and an offense that supports what you want to do defensively. And like you know, Joe, and I'm sure you've talked to Joe, my brother, you know, at some point, and he talks a lot about what he's doing, and it's crazy.
Right.
You know, I think he just won 96-91 last night in the first round of their conference tournament. And part of you saying, that's crazy, but what you give up allows you to do what you want to do on the offensive end. So your defense supports your offense supports your defense, and what do you have there? Well, you have flow. There's a rhythm to the game, and ultimately you want to get the rhythm in the way you want it, right? That supports your game, your team. And I think it's hard to find rhythm in the game today, let alone establish it as a team. And I think that's going to hold the Big Ten back. It's going to hold back some of these really physical conferences, because we've seen it in the Big 12 as well.
Yeah. Well, it's the officials, by the way, I have great respect for, as do you.
Yes.
Great respect.
Yes.
Really hard job. And I think it's the direction they're getting from their respective leads in the conference offices that's causing how they're calling it. It's not a personal decision.
No, and ultimately, you're talking about people making rules and points of emphasis who don't actually call games. They're not actually there. They don't really get in the flow. They get in the black and white of the game, and the reality is, like I always say, again, the game is played in the gray.
This is what I'll give you an example where the game is played in the gray. The game is played in the gray with that little arm bar. The game is played in the gray where off a cut you grab the jersey, right?
Yep.
Well, you can't see the jersey. Okay, that's where it's being played. I've always maintained, John, that you take the first 2 weeks of the season and you put it down as to how you're going to call it, and you clean up stuff like that. You kind of use the first 2 weeks like the NFL or the NBA uses the preseason to then set precedent. That's how I've looked at it.
Yeah, and what's getting hard is the game is called one way in non-conference, and it's called differently in conference play. And the other thing we're seeing, which is just a reality of just the human dynamics of things, is ultimately – fans have affected officiating this year, and we've seen that because last year there were no fans. This year, you can see the human side of it with officials. And again, like people say, oh, you're criticizing. No, I'm not.
I'm
pointing out the realities of being a human being. When you went from having no one in the stands and different levels of conversations with coaches to now, you feel the emotions of a game again. And I think there's been an adjustment period for officials, but also when you have someone leaning on your every call, I mean, what is that like? That's like a coach saying, don't miss this shot.
Right.
Like, well, what are you going to do? Now I'm trying too hard to make the shot. Well, when you say you need to get this call right, now you're looking for it. You're not officiating a game with instincts. Because I think the game, when it's officiated with instincts, what happens is they call what they see and they see what they feel. Right. And that's important. Like, yep. That tells me more truth about a game than anything else.
Yep.
But when we're told to call this so you look for this, there's an imbalance. It's funny. It's like we have a global issue, right, a societal issue, where we try to find balance with imbalance, mm-hmm. right? Like, something's out of balance, so what do? We apply imbalance to it to fix it, and it never fixes it.
Right.
It just causes a greater issue. I mean, that's universal, and ultimately it's a human dynamic. It's part of the human condition. And that's playing out in basketball. The problem is, man, the value of basketball makes it even tougher to live with. Mm-hmm. The value to these kids, the values to these institutions, all we want is some consistency, because with consistency, we have growth.
Right. Well, that's why, you know what separates the really good teams? The really good teams get separated because, guess what? They're rarely in the close games where the call makes a difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're rarely in close games. Okay. In other words, you're winning the game by 10 to 15. Does it really matter how it got called? That's why they're never in those predicaments.
Yes. And they're also adaptable teams by nature, in the sense that, look,
sure.
I give these speeches and I always say things like, you know, the best teams don't win with set plays anymore. The best teams win with adjustments. Well, why is that? Well, look, we're in a fluid world. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
So you don't win a game based on running your set play and it actually works. You win a game by preparing yourself to adapt to the game and adjust to the game and counter what a team does, feel the game out, make adjustments throughout. Like, those are the teams that do well, but ultimately you have to adjust yourself to the way the game's being called. The problem is, with five fouls and Zach Edey gets one early, he's out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
He's out of the game. And now you completely change the team's entire rotation in terms of how they operate. I just wish we went to six fouls where you can get away with one and you say, hey, this is what we're calling. It's up to the team now to adjust to it. But the rules we have in place right now, it doesn't really afford that opportunity.
I've seen games lost where on the two-foul thing, where they sit the guy down and they go the rest of the half without him. You're looking around.
Game's over.
You know how many games have you done, right? And we can compare notes here, where somebody really good got two fouls, coach, you know, may have taken him out for a little bit, but stuck him back in the first half and never got the third foul in the game.
Yeah, but never played the same way either.
Yeah, probably not.
I saw it at Michigan with Purdue. Purdue was at Michigan.
Yeah.
Zach Edey got his first foul within like a minute and a half in the game.
Yeah.
And he goes out. And he doesn't really play. And now their entire rotation is differently. And I remember telling Brian Custer, I was calling the game, and I said,
yeah,
this is not going to be good for Purdue because this is a completely different approach to the game where Trevion Williams is now the starter, and it changes your rotations. You're playing with different guys. You're playing different roles. And I said, this is going to be a challenge for Purdue. Sure enough, they lost.
And Caleb First had to play a lot more.
Yes.
And he's at this stage, he's not ready to do that. Next year, probably, but now, no.
No, it's a challenge. I hope we can get it right. I mean, the problem is, you know, when you have something that is so valuable like college basketball, mm-hmm. the bureaucracy really flexes its muscles. And I wish that there were just more rational heads that say, look, I don't care, you know, about the political side of the sport. I just want to see the sport grow.
Yes.
I want to see the sport be better.
Yep.
I want better rules, the rules that allow the game to be played the way the game is being played anyway.
Right.
You know, and it's not, it doesn't mean let's make the game the NBA. It's not the NBA because our players aren't that good. Let's be honest.
Right.
You know, but we should have a you know, international rules should flow to the college game. You know, a wider lane, extend the restricted arc out further, more plays at the rim, allow guys to take the ball off the rim, a live ball off the rim. I think it's terrific for the game. It creates flow, creates more scoring opportunities. You know, but again, pull that restricted arc out and play to that right to verticality, which is so key. I think that's helped the game. Let's play to it. But instead, you put a restricted arc 2 feet away from the basket where someone like myself or my brother could dunk from there.
Yeah.
Like, you're talking about elite level athletes. Widen the lane, extend the restricted arc, more plays at the rim, better flow, and six fouls. So you're not taking the best players off the floor for what could be a questionable call.
Yeah. I mean, Brandon Watkins could dunk from there. No, I'm just kidding.
You're right. You are right.
I just, everybody, people going back, yeah. Younger people like, who? Okay.
Hey, Steve, I did that game at Penn State. It was a Michigan game.
Oh, I know. I couldn't get down to see it.
I know, but I didn't make it to shoot around because I was doing radio. But
right.
The kids behind me are saying, "Hey, we need another one of those 2001 banners up." And I go, "Hang on a second." I said, "What year are you guys?" I'm a senior, and I go, "When were you born?" 99. You're a senior in college, and you were born in 99. Like you were barely alive when I was playing. Oh wow, that's where we're at.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah. I told the story today to my class. So I asked each person in class, because the play-by-play project's their next one. So I said, yep. So I asked who's done play-by-play, and there's like four kids put their hands up. So I asked about their first experience. So then one of them asked me, well, what date was your first experience? I said, December 8th. I said, December 8th, 1977.
I mean, and they're like, my dad wasn't even born in 77. That's pretty much what you're dealing with.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
I prefer to think of myself as experienced. John.
Yes. Seasoned.
Very seasoned. My friend, thanks so much. Great that you're in demand. You should be. You're awesome at it. So
I appreciate it. It's good to be working. Good to be around the game.
Yeah,
it's a pleasure.
It's great to have you with us, brother. Appreciate it so much.
Thanks, man.
All right.
Thank you.
See you, John.